the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom has cleared off his desk that for the past few days was cluttered with bills hoping to become laws. We'll hear about which ones got ink and which ones stayed blank. Plus, last year, Stockton, California tried it. Last month, Long Beach said they'd try too. Hear how universal basic income turned one person's life around. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Coming up, an argument for universal basic income from one woman in the program created by Stockton Mayor Tubbs, known as SEED.
If it wasn't for SEED and Mayor Tubbs, I would be homeless. It kept me alive. It wasn't just a float.
That's coming up ahead. But we start in Sacramento, where the final word is in on which of this year's bills will become law in California. Governor Gavin Newsom had to wrap up his signing and vetoing of legislation by midnight, and he saved a few of the most important bills for last night to review some of the most significant new laws in California and how they'll change our state in the months to come. We have Katie Orr, the politics and government reporter for public radio station KQED. Now, Katie, all eyes were on the police reform bills yesterday, and he signed two that were on his desk. First, tell us about Assembly Bill 1506 and what the new law would do.
Right. This is a law from Assemblyman Kevin McCarty, and he's tried to get this passed for several years. Basically, what it will do is take the investigations of some police shootings out of the hands of local prosecutors and move it to the attorney general's office. And I should say these are shootings that result in the death of an unarmed civilian. So not all shootings, but some of the most serious ones. Previous efforts and this year have been opposed by the attorney general's office. Javier Becerra opposed this one, and Kamala Harris actually opposed similar efforts when she was attorney general as well.
All right, now AB 1196 would formally ban the use of chokeholds and neck restraints by law enforcement. What are the specifics on that one?
So this is a bill that is in direct response to the killing of George Floyd. Just like it says, it would ban police from detaining suspects using a chokehold, and it would also ban what they called carotid artery restraints, which is what happened to George Floyd. And that's when there is pressure put on a vein in your neck and it actually stops the blood flow. And as we know, these can be very deadly restraints. They're sometimes not used correctly. And so this bill bans police officers from using those.
You know, and yesterday, right in the middle of our show, Gavin Newsom signed what has been called the reparations bill, which was put forward after the death of George Floyd and the ensuing protests. Can you tell us a little bit about what exactly this would do and why it's significant that it'll become law?
Yeah, this will actually be the first law of its kind in the country. And it's very interesting that it's happening in California, but Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who authored this bill, said, just because we're not a Georgia or an Arkansas or a Mississippi, that doesn't mean California doesn't have its own past that it has to come to grips with. The important thing to remember here is that this bill is not going to just start giving people reparations. It's a task force that's going to be set up to study and look at what the impact of slavery truly was and what reparations might look like for Black Californians. You know, it might be money, it might not. We don't know, but that's important to remember. No one's going to start like getting a check tomorrow.
Now, another bill addressing diversity and equity is AB 979. Tell us about that and how it will move forward once law.
Yes, this is a bill that seeks to add diversity to corporate boards for corporations based here in California. There are over 600 corporations that are headquartered in the state. And this law requires that they have at least one person from an underrepresented community on their board by the end of 2022. They have to have that position filled by 2022. And then they have to appoint additional members from underrepresented communities in the following years. And it's different based on the size of the board. It's similar to a law that was recently passed in California that requires corporations to have women on their boards. And both of these are an effort to really try and add more diversity to these boards. And also supporters say to give people from these communities, like Black and Brown communities, women, someone to look up to on these boards, you know, to say like, you can be here, your voice is represented, and we don't just keep seeing white men basically making these decisions. And I should say legal challenges, the one with women on corporate boards has seen legal challenges. This one is likely to see legal challenges. There's an argument that California can't really regulate this because while these corporations are based in this state, they might be incorporated in other states. And so who really has jurisdiction there? So expect some legal fights to come.
Looking back in the month, Katie, what would you say are some of the most significant bills that the governor signed?
Well, I think one that we can't forget and we've talked a lot about is AB 3088. And that was the eviction moratorium deal for people who have lost their jobs because of the COVID pandemic. It provides some protection for renters through February, depending on when they lost their job. They either can't be evicted for not paying rent, or they have to pay 25% of their rent through February. It didn't give renters all of what they were looking for, but it gave them something while giving some protections to landlords.
Talking to Katie Orr, a politics and government reporter at KQED based in Sacramento. All right, what about some of the bills that Governor Newsom decided to veto? Which ones stand out?
Yeah, he vetoed one, and this was kind of interesting, AB 3216. It is about recall and retention for hospitality workers, people, you know, who work in hotels, especially, but also in airports, janitorial employees. And what this bill would have done is said that if a company lays somebody off because of the pandemic, then the company would be required to rehire that person first before going for a new employee, someone younger. Basically, it's like you have to rehire based on seniority. And the point is to give those workers some sense of security that their job will come back, because they're often, you know, minorities, low income positions, a lot of women, they need to know that they're going to have another job. But Newsom said he thought that this bill would threaten an already kind of unstable industry right now. And so he didn't feel like he wanted to go forward with it.
Now, what about 1845?
Yeah, 1845. This one was actually surprising, too, because this would have established an office to end homelessness. And that is something that Governor Newsom has made a priority since he came in office. But he said that creating an office just about homelessness, in effect, silos the issue. And he didn't feel like that was something that would help the problem. He said it would lead to more fragmentation, not less. He points out that his office has already invested more than $2 billion in new direct aid for homelessness, and he didn't feel this office was the way to go in continuing to tackle the problem.
Okay, what about some of the laws that did not make it to the governor's desk, but will likely return to the legislative bodies in some form or fashion next year?
Yeah, and I touched on some of these. I think we will definitely see more police reform bills. Those measures can take a while to get through because they are so controversial with law enforcement groups. I would not be surprised if we saw like the ban on using projectiles and tear gas to break up protesters that failed this year. Also, the measure this year that would have decertified police officers who were convicted of certain serious crimes, that failed to make it out of the legislature. I think we'll see that again. There were multiple housing bills having to do with being able to build duplexes on lots versus just single family homes and updating density bonus laws and things like that that didn't move forward, that I'm sure we will see again, especially since several of them were backed by Senate leader Tony Atkins. So those will be another big decision, as well as possibly ongoing COVID-19 bills as the state continues to deal with the pandemic.
You know, Katie, the legislative session was really unprecedented in a lot of ways. Actually, weird is probably the best way to put it, between the pandemic and the nationwide protests against racial injustice and the way our leaders in Sacramento acted. Can you give us a year in review? What set this session apart?
You're right. It was weird. I've covered, I think this was my seventh session, and it started off in March just being bizarre because they had so many longer unplanned recesses because of COVID-19. You know, they took a couple weeks off in March, and then they took more time off because two assembly members had tested positive. And then they came back in August because they had to finish up the session. and they were dealing with a senator who tested positive and possibly exposed the entire Senate Republican caucus. So you had all of those things that you were working around. Plus, you had tensions, which are fairly typical between the Assembly and the Senate, which people argue led to the death of the Senate leader's housing bills. The Assembly Speaker totally denies that. He says that's not the case. But that was an element as well. And I think one of the most interesting things about that is progressives in the legislature thought they were poised for a very successful year, given the COVID and given the national mood and all of that. And in the end, I think they had a it was good. You know, they got a couple, measures across the finish line. But like, especially in terms of police reform that we've talked about and housing, they certainly didn't get as much as they want. I think a really good example of what a struggle that is the fight to expand unpaid parental leave in California. And this was the bill that Buffy Wicks ran down to the floor with her newborn baby in her arms to vote on. It's just interesting that they needed her vote to get that bill across the finish line. And this is in progressive California. So it just tells you that there is a very strong moderate force in the legislature as well. And I think that that's something we're going to see. The battle between the progressives and the moderates is going to play out even more next year.
That's Katie Ora, politics and government reporter for KQED based in Sacramento. Katie, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, coming back down to Los Angeles, LA's homeless services system is supposed to take people from the street and rehouse them quickly. But the reality is much different, as KPCC's homelessness reporter Matt Tinoco reports from Hollywood on one man's struggle to get indoors over the last few years.
I want to tell you about Hal, a disabled man who's currently living his life from a wheelchair beside a 7-Eleven off Sunset in Hollywood. His legal name is Halcyon Southmate. He's white, trans, and from Tennessee. And when he was 6, he was diagnosed with Stickler syndrome.
My prognosis was dead before 25.
He's made it to 37, but still battles daily with the painful and progressive genetic disease that leads to brittle bones and weak connective tissue.
That's why I'm wheelchair bound, because every step is excruciating and a fall risk.
Hal came to LA seeking safety 2 years ago. As his transition became apparent to his friends and family in Tennessee, it became clear to him that he was no longer welcome.
So I'm not staying where I'm not wanted. And it turns out that I'm not really wanted in California either.
I first met him last year at a protest demonstration in Central Hollywood. It was against local opposition to people living on the street.
Toilets, not tickets!
These rich old white folk around here think they better than us because they're housed and we're not. We're still a part of this community and you can't run us off.
At that time, Hal was actually in a shelter. He was one of the first residents of a bridge home site nearby. It's one of several built through an initiative by LA Mayor Eric Garcetti to provide homeless people with a temporary place to stay before being placed in housing. There, Hal had access to supportive services, bathrooms, showers, and 3 meals a day. He was also told he'd likely find housing after about 90 days, so he and his partner signed up. But while they were off the street, the shelter was far from ideal. The food served wasn't consistent with his doctor's dietary restrictions, and it was still a big shelter. Lots of beds in a big open space with constant noise causing sleepless nights. And another thing.
The contract that we signed when we went in there promised us safety.
But Hal didn't feel safe. Frequent fights, racial and transphobic threats, some even directed right at Hal. Plus, he often saw hard drugs being used inside the shelter. That's because of a model called harm reduction, and the idea is to provide a place where people can detox with support. While hard drugs aren't allowed on site, active substance use won't get you kicked out of the program. Hal thinks harm reduction is a great idea, but the practical reality of someone illicitly smoking meth in the next bunk, it was stressful.
You cannot expect to house two groups of differing people together and expect that to work.
He says he reported this to the shelter's administrators, but little changed. 90 days passed, and 90 days passed again, but his caseworkers still couldn't locate wheelchair-accessible, affordable housing. Finally, after 8 months inside, Hal and his partner, they were kicked out after a fight. He says they were defending themselves in a violent situation, but that they had to leave because they were deemed a danger to the staff. His departure makes him one of the 105 people who have left the site since it opened in March of 2019. Only 29 people have left for permanent housing. The other 76 exited the program either voluntarily, moved to another interim shelter, or, like Hal, were asked to leave. When he left, he went back to the street nearby. But now, something had changed. The area where Hal stays now is in a city-designated special enforcement and cleaning zone. That means every weekday, sanitation teams and police show up to confiscate unattended items on the sidewalk. The zone is part of a deal to coax local residents on board with the shelter by providing extra police enforcement to keep other homeless people from setting up camp nearby.
So yeah, I'm like smack in the middle of that zone.
For Hal, it means never leaving his possessions unattended and defending them by reciting legal code to police officers that permit him to remain in place. I asked Hal why he doesn't move somewhere else, given the amount of effort it takes to remain at this particular location.
Because I am disabled, and I get all of my medical care through the LGBT Center on Schrader.
On Schrader Boulevard, he has doctors who are familiar not only with Stickler syndrome, but also the particularities of being transgender.
Able-bodied people can bounce from doctor to doctor to doctor because they don't have this long list of medical conditions and interactions and medications.
And that long list has him staying right here.
I will be 38 next month. I don't got a whole lot of good years left. I can't waste them training new doctors. This is where I need to be.
Covering homelessness, I'm Matt Tinoco.
I know we spent a lot of time talking about California's fire season, but it's important that you don't get to a point where it's just accepted as the way things are here. What's happening in California with its constant wildfires chewing up millions of acres should not be chalked up to the new normal. It's not. Coming up, we'll hear how California's redwoods might be the next population of trees to face those long-term wildfire consequences. That's next when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Summer has come and passed. The innocent can never last. Wake me up when September ends.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. September has ended. It is October, but the way the heat makes you feel right now, it's pretty much like summer has not ended. It is very hot out there, and the National Weather Service has issued red flag warnings for various parts of the state due to the weather and dry conditions. Now, because of this and the, quote, highly dangerous fire conditions in the region, it was announced yesterday that the Angeles National Forest will remain closed until October 8th. The good news, though, the Bobcat fire burning in that region is now 75% contained. Up north in the wine country, however, the Glass fire was still growing. As of this morning, it's only 5% contained and has already chewed through more than 56,000 acres. Yeah, it's only October 1st, and already we have seen some of the worst wildfires in state history, and it's jeopardizing all sorts of natural areas that we hold dear. For more, we have environment reporter Julie Cart. She's been tracking fire season so far for the news site Cal Matters. Julie, can you put this current fire season in context for us? How bad is it?
Well, we're kind of running out of context for what we're seeing with fires in California. This is the worst fire season ever, which it's starting to sound familiar. Every year we say the same thing. This is 4 million acres burned, and we're, as you suggested, the Southern California fire season is just now kind of getting underway. So that's shocking. Last year, there were only 270,000 acres burned, so that was a quiet year, but it's still way ahead of anything that's ever happened in the state. 30 people dead. It's just awful.
And the frightening thing, Julie, is, you know, you said it's the worst wildfire season ever, but I mean, that phrase, we can almost hold it and paste it for possibly 6 months from now, a year from now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you think of how people get awards and they send them off to an engraver, I mean, you wouldn't even bother setting anything in any kind of permanent type when it comes to fire records. They're just going to constantly be changed, so there's no sense in wasting your time. Yeah. Just leave it blank and keep updating.
Yeah. All right. So just stepping back for a second, these huge fires seem to be driven by a confluence of factors exacerbated by climate change. But in your reporting, you've identified some key factors. So, Julie, what are they?
Well, you're right. It's climate. But years and years of drought, and everything's interconnected, I'm going to mention. The management of the forests, they are denser than they've ever been in the history of our forests. So there's a lot of fuel sitting there waiting to burn. We've had in California over the last 5 or 6 years, 160 million trees dying from various epidemics, beetles, all kinds of oak deaths. So it's just so many, it's a confluence of so many things. And when you have this kind of heat and wind and things are very dry, it doesn't take much to start a pretty serious fire.
Julie, you know, I started this job at KPCC in August of 2012, so 8 years ago. And when I first started, I came from sports, so I wasn't quite aware of what was going on when it comes to, you know, just our basic living here in California politically and with policy. But one of the things that I first heard about is, look, we got to get ready for fire season as reporters, as a show, you know, get ready to report on it, what it means. But now that it's clear 8 years later, or even earlier than that, that we don't have a regular fire season anymore that we can plan for, what impact has that had?
It's tremendously impactful. The fire season is more than 2 months longer than it used to be. So it's almost year round. So these guys don't ever get a break. So in December, January, February, when Cal Fire would be standing down, they would be repairing equipment. They could lay some people off or put them on a furlough, save some money, help other jurisdictions, and mainly do the kind of work that does fireproof our forests. There's no time for that. We have fires in November. Think of the fire that burned the town of Paradise last year, the year before. So it's pretty awful. The season doesn't make sense anymore, and it just stretches the resources.
Yeah, that's the point, right? Because there was a time when we could exhale and try our best to prepare for what was coming later. But now that later is always happening in the moment, in the present, right now.
Yeah, they're always putting out a fire or dealing with fire. And it's really important to do that prep work. It's expensive, it's time consuming, and it's slow, but it's really critical. You can save communities by making them fire safe through various mechanisms, but you need a moment to do that, and nobody has the time anymore.
You know, about the forests and forest management, we heard the president again this week during the debate complain about California's management of the forests. We know that the federal government owns most of the forest land, at least in California. So what is the situation with those federally owned forests? Is that being cleaned with prescribed burns, or is anything being done to keep them clean, as he says?
Yeah, and it's not raking. Just to, you know, like everything else, COVID has impacted this work. The Forest Service did not undertake prescribed burns or any of this work because of the virus, because of the risk to the folks they had in the field. So that was a big blow. The state and the U.S. Forest Service have signed an agreement as a more or less an aspirational goal to combine their efforts and clear as much as 1 million acres a year in California. They are not even remotely close to that currently. Maybe a fourth of that gets done, maybe. So that's something they're launching. They're going to try to do it, but they can't. They cannot do this work when there's high winds. They cannot do this work when it's hot, and they can't. There's just so many impediments to prescribing burns.
Talking to Julie Cart from Cal Matters, you said the aspirational goal. I can imagine if someone has been a victim of wildfires in California, that statement or that little phrase right there has to infuriate them. An aspirational goal when so much is at stake.
Well, we all have a role to play.
Yeah.
You don't want to blame victims, but there are lots of communities where maybe they're second homes, and those folks who come up on the weekend don't really feel like doing the drudge work, clearing that is required. People like the aesthetics of redwood decks and shake roofs, and they're exactly the wrong thing to have as part of your home. It doesn't help fireproof your home. Communities, just as a whole, instead of individuals, need to do this work. They often don't have the money, or they don't want to do the burns because of the smoke and how that irritates. I mean, there's some health issues. There's plenty of blame to go around. Everyone has to do their part, and not everyone is, that's for sure.
You mentioned redwood decks. I want to ask you about the coastal redwoods. You've recently written about them. It was thought that the redwoods were somewhat immune to the ravages of fire, given their misty environment. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, they used to be called or referred to as the asbestos forests, which is... As with most things with fire, a little bit of an overstatement. There's always been fires in coastal California, but they're quite different. The intensity has always been low, and we've had fog and a lot of moisture that keeps it all down. There's just been incredible research about the reduction of fog up and down the California coast. Obviously, the moisture is not there as well because of the sun is beating down. It's been hotter. There's a lot of information and data about how nighttime temperatures keep rising. So it's sad to say that there really is no place that's not going to burn, and they're the last bastions of this, but they're as vulnerable as everybody else.
Yeah, a few weeks ago I talked to someone who studies redwoods and how they manage to bounce back so quickly if they do have to deal with a fire. And I likened it, Julie, to the Marvel superhero Wolverine, in that they repair themselves a lot quicker than, say, other trees. But that this concern over their survivability, I mean, it's just, what's the thinking there? Because, I mean, is this really something real that the redwoods, which I think for a lot of people, especially Californians, Julie, is a symbol of the state, is this something that we need to worry about in the future, that they might not survive as well as in the past?
Well, if you're going to have a symbol, that's a pretty cool one.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the largest trees on Earth. They're the largest growing things on this planet, and that's pretty cool. I mean, they live more than 1,000 years if we leave them alone. So they have adapted to fire. They've always been exposed to fire. They have this bark that is just this armor that, you know, I dare you to get through me kind of thing. They resprout right away. They're just, you know, they're built. They want to live. But, of course, that we could lose them. We certainly could lose the density of these forests, the number of trees. If the soils become compromised, there's a lot of runoffs and their roots, you know, there's any number of things. I don't think anyone's talking about burning down these forests, or that that all of the trees won't come back. I think it'll be something along the lines of what we saw with Joshua trees out in the Mojave, with burning through Joshua Tree National Park. I mean, some aren't going to come back. And what comes back will look different. It will replace that landscape. That's just to be expected.
Some of those redwoods, the coastal redwoods, have been growing since the Roman Empire. Just to put it in perspective, how long they have stood. And yeah, it's just, that would be terrible. Really quick, Julie, in the minute we have left, earlier we were talking about bills that the governor signed and did not sign. Anything we should be aware of in regards to the state's plan to fight wildfires?
The money that it always sets aside, wildfire bills and response, is always very high on the priority in the legislature. Everything got superseded by COVID, so there's not a lot of movement. There's no money.
All right. That's Julie Cart of Cal Matters. Julie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, last year, Stockton, California tried it. Last month, the city of Long Beach, right here near us, said they would try it too. And actually, you can thank former Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang for putting it out there on the national stage. Yeah, it's Universal Basic Income, UBI, Universal Basic Income. Now, I know you've heard about it, but up next, hear how Universal Basic Income works and how, for one woman, it has turned her life around. It actually contributed to her survival. Her story is coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
I'm going back down maybe one more time, deep down home, October Road.
In fact, now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the NPR One app, I'm E. Martinez. The idea of universal basic income, popularized by Andrew Yang's campaign during the Democratic primaries, is gaining steam. Last month, the city of Long Beach voted in support of a pilot program for a select group of city residents. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti and Compton Mayor Asia Brown are also exploring guaranteed income initiatives. No word yet, though, on the next steps for those programs. But to see if such a program can actually work, they could look no further than Stockton, California. Since last year, Stockton has been giving $500 a month, no strings attached, to 125 working people living in that city. That program will run until January 2021. Laura Kidd-Plummer is in Stockton's basic income program, and before she was accepted, she was having a hard time.
I was in a situation where I worked for the Oakland Coliseum for 21 years. I took off for about 6 months to work on President Obama's campaign. I was sent to Las Vegas for 6 months. And during that time, think about the last week before we were to leave, I tripped and fell and dislocated my knee. So when I got back to Oakland, I couldn't work at the Coliseum. They had no light duty. The job that I was doing for President Obama's campaign was through our union. So I went and worked for them light duty for about 8 months. And then they told me I no longer could work light duty. So I wound up having to retire early. And then doing all of this, I was priced out of my apartment up in Oakland. I couldn't afford to live up there anymore. So that's how I wound up moving to Stockton.
Okay, so were you having trouble making ends meet, though? Sounds like you had at least a little bit of a struggle with that.
Oh, I had a big struggle with it because of me not having this happen on my job. I was, you know, at another job. It was kind of, they were back and forth as to who was going to take care of it. So it took me almost a year to get my disability. And when you're living somewhere, they want you to pay your rent on time. And I don't like being behind and having people knock on my doors and stuff. So I just moved out the lady's place and found a place down here. A friend told me that they had some openings and the rent was a lot cheaper. So that's why I came down this way.
Okay, great. So then you get to Stockton and you get to be part of this basic income program. How did life for you change when you started taking part?
Well, it changed drastically because I was hitting food banks like crazy just trying to eat, let alone pay the bills that I had incurred during this time of not having any income. I was really surprised. I've worked all my life and raised three children by myself, and nobody's ever given me anything. When I first heard about it, I was like, wow, how nice is that? I'm really happy for the people that are going to get it. And then a couple of weeks later, I got a letter in the mail. I cried because I couldn't believe it was happening to me. But it helped get me out of that struggle I was going through because I was still waiting for disability.
So then when the income started rolling in, the basic income program from Stockton, when that started rolling in, how were you using it? What were you able to do that you weren't able to do before?
Well, what I was doing, I had picked up a couple of credit cards here and there, and it was a thing where I was using those to live on until that money started. I was buying groceries there, so I had incurred a couple of bills just trying to survive this stuff. When the money started rolling in, though, it made me able to start paying some of the stuff off that I had been using during this time. I've even paid my car off.
Oh, wow.
A 2007 HHR. Yeah, I just paid it off last month. So I've just been trying to catch up and pay everybody and get everything squared away so that when it stops in January, which was another big thing because it was supposed to stop in 6 months, but then they extended it to a year. It was extra money to help me to get in this place that I'm in. It was really expensive and it was hard to find. But if it wasn't for Seed and Mayor Tubbs, I would be homeless.
So it sounds like Stockton's basic income program, Laura, not only just kept you afloat, it almost might have kept you alive.
No, it did. It kept me alive. It wasn't just afloat. I had some serious issues going on. But they say if you hang in there, you'll reap the benefits of whatever you're going through.
We're talking to Laura Kidd Plummer, recipient of Stockton's Basic Income Program. Can you walk us through, Laura, how the program works? Do you get a monthly payment deposited into your bank account? Is that how it works, or is it work different for you?
Well, no, they have a card that they put it on monthly, and mine comes on the 15th of the month. So I pay my regular bills, well, the first of the month bills out of my Social Security. And then when the 15th rolls around, I'm able to go and pay, you know, all the rest of them. It's really keeping me afloat. It really is. And at this point, I've come to the conclusion I've had enough of this workman's comp. I'm still dealing with that. So I'm settling with them. And out of doing that, I remembered years ago that they had a program through the disability and stuff that if you couldn't go back to your job, that they would retrain you or help retrain you for some other work. And I know I'm 70 years old, but I'm still getting around pretty good and I can use the extra money. So I've signed up to go back to school to try and find something that.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, that I can deal with. So things are looking better and better. I'm smiling.
Let me ask you this, though. Then, OK, so you just said you're going to sign up for this training program. If the basic income wasn't there, would you be able to sign up for that program? Or is that the reason, you know, you have this money coming in, so you're able to sign up for this program to get back into the workforce?
Yes. Well, the money helps you to do a lot of things. I mean, if you have no money coming in, you're sitting twiddling your thumb trying to figure out how you're going to get out to do different things. So, no, it does help. It definitely helps. And in knowing that it's coming to an end, I feel that people should not just be laying down once they get this money. They need to be making ends meet to the ends where it's easier for them once they come out of it.
Yeah, because Laura, some critics of this program will say, well, it's a windfall for people. It's like an extra cash so they can spend it on stuff that maybe they don't need. But it sounds like for you, I mean, it gives you breathing room to be able to kind of take stock of where you are, figure out what you're going to do next, and not feel the pressure of having to stay alive.
Exactly, exactly. I just, I hope that they select people that are really trying to do something. And I think the majority are. There's a few that aren't. But I think the bulk of people are really trying to get themselves straight, you know, most of the time. You know, some people look at me and say, man, you just pay bills all the time. Well, I made them, so I got to pay them,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Laura. So we mentioned how the program is coming to an end in January. But let's just say, you know, like we could wave that wand and make this thing be long term. What would it mean for you, for your life, to have this income as a long term thing?
Wow. You know, I can't even, it's hard to even imagine, because like I told you at first, nobody's ever given me anything. And for them to be smart enough to increase it for another 6 months just had me overjoyed. But to have it for a longer length of time, you know, I'm kind of a weird person. I'd love to, because it would make things easier for me. But then I feel like I'm stopping someone else from being able to get to the point that I'm at. And I'm kind of a person that kind of looks out for other people.
That's not weird, Laura. That's not being weird. That's called being a nice, good person.
Well, yeah, but I know some people are going to say, oh, she's weird or she's stupid or whatever. But no, rather than give me long, long term like that, spread it out and pass it around so more people can get a little bit of this to try and get up on their feet.
That's Laura Kidd Plummer, a recipient of Stockton's Basic Income Program. And Laura, you don't need advice from me, but every once in a while, it's fine to treat yourself. So don't forget that, okay?
Okay, I won't.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Could be argued that one of the results of having a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border is that it keeps people apart. You're either standing on one side or the other. The wall and what it means, subjective, politicized too, but as far as keeping people apart, well, that's debatable when one specific thing is involved. Find out what it is when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm A. Martinez. The border wall between the U.S. and Mexico is something that I'd bet more Americans have heard about than have actually visited. And if they have heard of it, it's usually in the context of politics.
Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall.
Well, there's a new documentary on HBO Max that takes us to the strip of wall between San Diego and Tijuana. And the context is not politics, it's music.
Que viva México! Que viva Fandango!
Fandango at the Wall is a documentary about an annual gathering called Fandango Fronterizo, where musicians from both sides play together. It was founded by our guest, Jorge Francisco Castillo, who joins us with the film's director, Varda Barkar. All right, so Jorge, let's talk about the origin of Fandango Fronterizo, because this film documents the gathering in 2018, which was unique because the Afro-Latin jazz ensemble from New York joined in. But you had started it years before. So how did it first start and why did you do it?
Back in 2007, when we started in San Diego, we were having fandangos in Tijuana, and we would used to drive across the border and have a fandango in Tijuana. Then we'll try to do the same thing and invite our friends from Tijuana, but for political reasons or, you know, like visas, passports, documentation, 89%, 90% of them could not cross the border. Mm. And it just happened that I was at the border in the Playas de Tijuana, on the Mexican side where we have the fandango right now. I was invited by a friend and I saw these families in the U.S. side, and we start talking, shaking hands. I remember a little boy who was about 5-6 years old who handed me a bottle of water, and it went through the fence, the water. So I was like, wow, this is beautiful. And right there, I got this idea.
Varda, in the film, there are overhead shots of the wall that show both sides of it from many angles. Tell us what your thinking was in terms of how you wanted to shoot it and what you wanted to show visually. Because in a way, that's a character in this film, I feel.
Absolutely. Initially, it was this, when we were talking about how the music knows no bounds. And, you know, just like the way that the birds fly over the wall, so does the music. And we were talking a lot about that kind of, you know, imagery. And so I was thinking, how can we capture that? We use drones, and Sergio Valdez, actually, who is a native of Tijuana, because the whole film is a cross-cultural collaboration on every level. It was his drone and he operated it. And he's a wonderful cinematographer as well. Anyway, when we talked about doing it, he said, well, do we have permission? And I said, well, no, we don't. And he said, well, it might get shut down. And I said, I know, you know, and he said, but, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. Let's do it. And so, you know, we did it knowing that we might not get it, but we did. And we got very fortunate there.
That's the thing about a wall, right? A wall is there to divide one side from the other side, or to stop something from moving through. I mean, that's kind of the point of a wall. I'm wondering, Varda, what surprised you the most about the wall itself when you were actually there?
I didn't understand going in before I'd actually seen it, that it was so on the Tijuana side, that it was so decorated with art. Mm. And then on the other side, it's this park that had been named Friendship Park, but it's stuck and you're not even allowed in there. So I was surprised by the contrast of the two. Not so much, I try when I'm making a film not to be judgmental, just kind of see things as they are, not put anything on it. So just purely from, you know, the experiential aspect of it. This is what I experienced. Yeah.
I want to play a clip of you driving with the musicians Arturo O'Farrell and Kabir Segal, who are there from New York. Now, Kabir is also a producer of this documentary. Here's a clip of Kabir talking with you guys in the movie. So let's play it and come back to discuss.
We all come from kind of different, we're kind of like hyphenated Americans, right? I'm an Indian American. You're a Mexican Irish American. Jorge, you're bi-national, right? Mexican American. And so being a hyphenated American, I think, is increasingly the future, because Hispanics are going to be the largest majority group in America, if they aren't already. And it just, the sooner you encounter people who are different from you, it prepares you for the world.
And you're going to add me to that hyphenated list, Ecuadorian American. Jorge, how did having Kabir and Arturo visit Mexico with you and play at the border maybe change the way you think of the Fandango Fronterizo?
Definitely. It was very, very beautiful to me to have an Indian American and Cuban Mexican American from New York, and also having Varda there, who is also an immigrant from Romania. And so I was totally shocked with all this. But I think this is what it's all about. You know, Tijuana, it's a very diverse city. And Fandangos change their context a little bit according to the town you're at. And to have them on my side and to travel to Veracruz was great, was fantastic.
I'm talking with Jorge Francisco Castillo, the founder of Fandango Fronterizo, and Varda Barkar, director of a new film about that gathering called Fandango at the Wall. Varda, there seems to be a social justice component to the music and certainly to the gathering. Tell us a bit about that.
Throughout the making of the film, I would always marvel with Kabir. This was kind of like the law of attraction. It's the, you know, Sonoracha masters, musicians who are featured in the film, you know, Jorge, Kabir, Arturo, you know, Rahim and Saba, all the different, the Villalobos brothers, everyone involved in the film would, and the, even the, you know, the orchestra musicians were drawn to it and to this story because we all believe in the beauty and the value and the richness and the importance of cultural diversity and of all, you know, of all these differences, you know, coming together both to, you know, in celebration of life and also to address and solve the, you know, the challenges and the issues that we have together. And we had noticed that people, you know, living south of the border, you know, from the United States were being vilified and diminished, being, you know, forced to be in these cages, in things that we absolutely do not believe is just or humane and is not good for our society. And so in this festival, we thought it personified, you know, another way of looking at the world. And it's possible because we all know as, you know, kind of activist artists that we can imagine anything and realize it. So in other words, the reality that we're living now can shift instantly on a dime. Mm-hmm. If we decide to. And so that, I think, is the underlying, you know, sort of social justice, you know, theme in the film is both, that, you know, that we create the reality that we live in and that, you know, there's that we need to come together, all these different cultures and all these different languages and celebrate them and solve problems together rather than in division.
Let's listen to a clip from the film where one musician says that the music at Fandango is like a sledgehammer to the wall.
El verso es una campana. Que aquí teje nueva red, cura el hambre y la sed. Y les digo a bocajarro que el fandango es un gran marro de esta pequeña pared.
That's pure poetry, I can say.
He calls it a small wall to a pequeña pared. But exactly. Jorge, let me ask you this. The idea of the power of music is inspiring, but I have to wonder if you ever feel demoralized about the wall and what it symbolizes.
Well, when you're there, you can feel, you get all these feelings, you know, you get you start hearing the music and you get all these sensations that you feel like you're angry, you're sad, you see your friends on the other side, you're happy. And then it becomes more and more friendly as it goes. And at the end, the whole wall melts in front of you because you forget about it. And all of a sudden, it's just a fandango. No more wall.
Jorge Francisco Castillo is the founder of Fandango Fronterizo, and Varda Barkar is the director of a new film about that gathering called Fandango at the Wall. It is now on HBO Max. Jorge, Varda, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. And viva Fandango.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, just head to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. And that is good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.